good morning again, and welcome to all to this session of our panel. We have the court has five panels sitting this week. We actually have one panel sitting in Fort Worth at the law school there. The other panels are sitting here in New Orleans, and our panel is sitting in New Orleans. But today we're delighted to be out here at Tulane. Unlike some circuits, our circuit has a history of being friendly to sitting at law schools and so forth. We don't do it all the time, but it's, you know, fairly often that we will sit at various law schools. And so, as I said, this week we have a panel that's sitting at the law school in Fort Worth, which is the first time that we've been there, but we enjoy it. But what you'll see in here is exactly what would occur if we were in the John Minor Wisdom Building. It's a pleasure and honor for me to sit this week with Judge Jack Wiener. Judge Wiener, as maybe you may know, is a native of Shreveport. His family law firm is still there. His relatives there, me with his sister. And once upon a time, when I was a state trial judge, I actually presided over a case in which Judge Wiener was the litigant on one side and Honorable Tom Stack, U.S. District Judge, was the litigant on the other side. And it was about a 1,000-pound real estate ground lease that at 35 years of age, I was supposed to tell them what they meant when they mutually negotiated this lease. But at any event, the witnesses were intimidating, to put it mildly. But it's one of the fond memories that I have working with Judge Wiener, and so he is here. He's been in New Orleans for a while. My colleague to the right, Judge Southwick, from Jackson, Mississippi. At least for now he is, but he's going to be going to Austin to be near his, joining as a dear colleague, his prior military background. As Jordan said, with him, he's a scholar, very intellectually gifted, and so it's a pleasure to sit with him. So we have a batch of very interesting cases. You can't beat this job for variety, trust me. And so one of the things we slug through, we don't argue all the cases. So we have 20 cases on the docket. Maybe 10 or so maybe get argued. The others we're deciding on the briefs. So the cases that are set for argument, like these, are what I call the gray area cases. You know, and so we benefit from the argument of counsel to help us flesh out. Unlike when I was in state court, you know, judges might not know very much about it, and so the lawyers would get up and start in Genesis, telling you about the case, you know, and they work all the way to Revelation, you know, all they have. Here, it's what you call a hot bench. So we've read the briefs. We've probably, now in the electronic age, we've read the record. We've read the record excerpts. We've read the rulings of the judges. We've read a whole bunch of cases. Our law clerks are here with us. Most of the time, we have skull sessions to get ready for the case, and I explain to my wife, who wonders why I spend so much time there, that preparing for oral argument is like studying for finals. And so it's a lot goes in it. So when we get here, we're looking forward to hearing from counsel so that we can clarify in our heads what the cases are about and that today. So that said, we express appreciation to counsel for coming to Tulane to make your arguments as opposed to the courthouse. So that said, the first case for argument number 24-10172, United States versus Wesley Swick. Mr. Brown, you're up.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. One way or another, the district court erred. On the law, the district court's ruling on the fugitive tolling doctrine cannot be squared with the text, context, purpose, or history of the statutes governing supervised release. Before the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984 created supervised release, courts and Congress had consistently recognized the hand-in-hand relationship between the tolling doctrines for recidivists and fugitives. In Section 3624E, Congress chose to codify only one tolling doctrine, but not the other. That choice, therefore, communicates exclusivity, and this court should apply the negative implication canon to resolve the legal dispute in Mr. Swick's favor. As for the facts, the district court erred by equating evidence of Mr. Swick's failure to report for an initial meeting with evidence of fugitive status. In short, the district court could not infer from a single sin of omission the additional acts or intent necessary to support fugitive status, a classic sin of commission. On top of that, the district court compounded the error by overlooking all the evidence pointing in the other direction. At this point, I welcome the court's questions, but if there are none yet, I would like to begin today's presentation with with the legal dispute presented by this case.
Counsel, you say that 1984 Sentencing Reform Act brought forward one tolling and not the other. I'm curious, the Fifth Circuit panel withdrawn opinion somewhat took the same approach. What are you relying on to say that either it's general common law had tolling or some prior statute had tolling, and here are the categories, and only two of them were brought forward in the Sentencing Reform Act? Fair amount of research on that. I'm not seeing that there were these established, particularly as to something like supervised release, parole, probation, the kinds of clarity to the rules that, in a way, both sides are saying were there. So what are you relying on to say, here are the collection of things pre-1984, and here's what was brought forward in the statute?
I think the best evidence, Judge Southwick, is the Pre-Sentencing Reform Act parole statute. That's 18 U.S.C. section 4210. And in that statute, Congress saw fit not to rely on the common law, but to codify a tolling doctrine for recidivists and to codify a tolling doctrine for fugitives. So within
I'm familiar with 4210. It's not a worded statute in light of how supervised release works today, and parole commission is the center of that statute. But what Judge Willett wrote about in Cartagena, whatever the other name in that case is, withdrawn opinion, said, I don't remember now the wording, but basically clearly established common law was not rejected by either the 84 or the current, by the 84 statute. I'll leave it at that. Do you have anything that would show what the common law was outside of the statute?
We do, Your Honor. The repealed probation statute, section 3651, indicated that a period of probation together with any extension thereof shall not exceed 5 years. So that statute was unlike 4210 in that it did not codify either tolling provision. So without a contrary indication in the text, courts saw fit to import the common law approach that had been crafted to deal with escaped convicts and parolees to the probation context. And courts did that because the two tolling doctrines go hand in hand with one another. This court recognized that point in a case called United States v. Fisher from 1990. That was about the probation statute. That was building off the Fourth Circuit's work in a case called U.S. v. Workman from 1980. And Workman was addressing that probation statute and indicated that the efforts to calculate the maximum 5-year term had been the subject of considerable litigation. That was the term they used. And then they recognized that there were a series of tolling doctrines that had been drawn from the common law that all were unified with a common principle, which was that a probationer cannot obtain credit against the 5-year period for any period of time during which he was not, in fact, under probationary supervision by virtue of his own wrongful acts. They then applied that to both intervening imprisonment and fugitives because the rules were designed to do the same thing and to achieve the same purpose. So Congress is legislating in the Sentencing Reform Act not just against the background of the common law, which courts up until 1984 had imported into the probation statute, but they're also dealing with the background of the parole statute in which they had codified both of those common law rules. So if they were going to rely on the common law with supervised release, we would expect them to take the same all-or-nothing approach, either codify neither tolling doctrine and allow courts to apply the common law, or do what they did in 4210 and apply both. 3624E actually provides a mirror image to 4210, but with one significant omission. Just like 4210 did, 3624 gives us all the rules that we need to calculate a term of supervised release. We know when it begins. We know that it runs concurrently with any other forms of supervision, be they parole, supervised release, or probation. And we also know that it tolls during any period of imprisonment related to a conviction unless you serve less than 30 days. So,
Let me ask you about factual distinctions. Sure. This case, the subsequent offenses for which perhaps Judge O'Connor properly further sentenced him as a revocation, all occurred within the original time period of what supervised release would have been, correct?
I think that's right.
2017 to 2019. Other cases, including the Cartagena case, it was post that time period. So it really doesn't seem to me here we're talking about tolling, where in Cartagena maybe we were. We're trying to extend the time period in which the applicability of these terms, restrictions, conditions apply. Seems to me what we're really talking about here is something like effectuating the supervised release period during the period declared in the court order but the person never did appear to start his supervision. It seems to me there may be some distinction there where perhaps this case is a stronger one for saying those terms apply, that when he starts committing these crimes, your client, that the law would recognize that he's in that time period and it can be effectuated as Judge O'Connor did in this case. I'm making up terms, but isn't there some distinction?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think that goes to questions about purpose, that goes to questions about history. But ultimately, 3583 answers all those questions for us in subsection I. Subsection I preserves a district court's authority to revoke an individual like Mr. Swick, who either does not appear or begins committing crimes during a term of supervision, and it allows the district court to revoke them after the expiration of the term, so long as a warrant is issued during the term.
Let me ask you, what's the prominent standard of review? Are we looking just at de novo at the statutes, or the district court's inferences drawn from the evidence there? So what's our governing standard of review? You know, the judge looked at this, he drew the inference about your client's intent, et cetera. So that's not de novo, right?
That's not de novo, Your Honor. The question of fugitive of status is subject to the clear air standard of review, but these are separate issues. There is, on the one hand,
I just want to make sure we're on the same.
Well, and the good news for me is I only need one to win, and I think the de novo issue might actually present the easier win for us because I think all the evidence points in the same direction. So even if Mr. Swick is a fugitive, the fugitive tolling doctrine is not textually permissible given 3624E, given 3583E, and 3583I. On that point, Your Honor, I would like to follow up on the question of purpose. And I think this is an issue that Cartagena Lopez got wrong. I think it's an issue that the government got wrong as well, because they're taking a myopic approach to the question of supervised release and what is its purpose. So the fact of the matter is that supervision does have a rehabilitative purpose, but supervision is not the only goal that we can extract from the statutes governing supervised release. Those statutes have always allowed for recalcitrant offenders to face revocation. So there are, in fact, two purposes baked into the statute. The first is rehabilitation for those who submit to supervision, and the second is revocation for those who fail to submit and fugitives necessarily violate effectively all the terms of supervision. And that's been the case since the very beginning. 3583E, even before we had subsection I added to the statute in 1994, allowed for the revocation of supervisees, and the language of the statute prior to subsection I allowed for their revocation even after the term of supervised release, so long as a warrant was issued during the term. So ultimately,
let me take you back to my question.
Yes, sir.
If it took you all that to explain that, how in the world can the error, if error, be clear? I don't mean that facetiously. I just mean the standard is clear error. We write for multiple audiences, mm-hmm. as you know. One of the most important are the trial judges. And so we reverse to say, well, it was clear error, that O'Connor and the rest, like, hold them up. What am I supposed to do, right? So articulate for me what the panel's holding would be to say that the trial judge clearly erred so that he and other judges would know, oh, okay. I mean, I'm just saying the relief you wanted. I'm just saying, say for me, what would the articulation be of the clear error here?
Absolutely, Judge Stewart. I don't mean to fight the hypothetical or the premise of the question too hard, but at the outset, all I point out is if fugitive tolling does not apply, we don't even have to get to that factual question.
Gotcha.
But if fugitive tolling does apply and we get to the factual question, I think there's clear error here for two reasons. The first is that there's an obvious mismatch between the evidence the district court relied on to find fugitive status and the types of acts, evidence of intent that we would need to actually reasonably infer fugitive status from the facts on the record. And what I mean by that is a fugitive isn't just a violator. A fugitive goes beyond violation and attempts to erect an insurmountable barrier between himself and probation. So the classic evidence that we would look for in terms of fugitive status would be something like evasion or flight. Here, we have evidence of neither one of those points, and by confusing evidence of a violation with evidence of fugitive status, the district court made an unreasonable inference. I'm not arguing about whether or not there is competing evidence in the record or whether or not the district court made a reasonable inference from the evidence that was there. I'm saying there's no evidence of fugitive status, and that's one way to show clear error. I think that's a relatively straightforward rule that could be understood and applied in the future. But the problems are twofold because the district court didn't just ignore an evidentiary gap. It also overlooked all the evidence in the record pointing the other direction. So we know that Mr. Swick submitted to parole at the state level twice and for a total of about 8 months. We have that in the petition at record site 108, and we have that in the PSR that was put together for the new case at record sites 392 and 395. We also know that all of his arrests occurred in the same place, Wichita Falls, Texas, and there's no indication in the record that he ever left Wichita Falls following his discharge from TDCJ. You get that from the petition at record sites 105 to 108, and the new PSR from 394 to 96, and at 399. Now, we actually have additional evidence in the PSR that establishes his whereabouts. And again, this is not someone who's living under an assumed identity, and this is not someone who's taken flight in an attempt to avoid supervision entirely. We know the fact that he worked as a handyman for a landlord with multiple rental properties in Wichita Falls from June to September 2022. That's at record site 403. And the PSR indicates that he was living with a friend for about a month before his arrest in September 22. That's at record site 401. The last point on that I would make, Judge Stewart, is that in addition to all that evidence that undercuts the district court's finding of fugitive status, we also have his many arrests. And there's no indication that he ever tried to hide his identity or do anything else that would have erected a barrier between himself and probation. So when you have a situation where the district court...
Being a fugitive is not a passive status.
No, it's absolutely... You can't be a fugitive by accident. You have to take some sort of act, and it has to be intentional to erect an insurmountable barrier between yourself and probation, and we don't have anything along those lines here. And it wouldn't take much on the clear error standard. All we would need is some sort of admission from Mr. Swick, either to a pretrial services officer or police, or any other evidence of flight or evasion, and ultimately we have nothing. We've only got a minute and 40 seconds left, but I'd like to move back to the very beginning and talk about the negative implication issue again as it relates to the statutory question, which is, of course, on de novo review. So Congress and the courts recognized before the Sentencing Reform Act that fugitive tolling and tolling for recidivists went hand in hand. They had done so for many years, going back to the Supreme Court's 1923 decision, Anderson v. Corral. And because they go hand in hand, Congress's decision to omit the fugitive tolling rule in 3624 communicates exclusivity. Now, the negative implication necessarily depends on context, but the more specific the enumeration, the greater the force of the negative implication. And here, the associated group or series is a closed universe of two tolling rules. And before creating supervised release, Congress had expressly codified both in the parole context. So given that statutory history, Congress could have easily done the same in Section 3624E, but it did something different. And given that longstanding relationship between the two tolling doctrines, the decision to include one implies the exclusion of the other. And on that point, Your Honors, I would just recommend rereading the opinions from the 11th and 1st Circuit because they deal with that statutory history and they deal with the text of the statutes primarily. I think Cartagena and Lopez and the opinions coming out the other way are elevating context, purpose, and the common law to supreme importance when the statute itself answers the questions.
Does being a fugitive require intent?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it does.
What kind of intent?
Oh, intent to either evade supervision or to skip town, to leave the jurisdiction.
Okay.
I think in this case we have evidence of neither of those points. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brown. You've reserved your 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from the government. Ms. Green.
Allow me to ask you the same question at the beginning. Does being a fugitive require intent, and what kind of intent?
Yes, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the Court, Amber Grand for the United States. This Court explained in United States versus Fisher that the fugitive tolling doctrine is invoked when you have wrongful action or inaction. That's all that's required. We have to have wrongful action or inaction, and here that wrongful inaction was the failure to report for supervision, which led to a total and complete evasion of the service of that key component of his sentence.
So does that mean everybody who doesn't report for supervision is definitionally a fugitive?
The doctrine, of course, the court would have to assess the equitable doctrine and decide if their failure to report was an intentional effort to remove them from the court's supervision.
Well, if somebody knows they're on supervision, they know they're supposed to show up. They've got the piece of paper, they've been told, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, they know. So if they don't, they are not only in violation, but they're a fugitive.
If they fail to report to evade that portion of their sentence, the court in Murguia-Oliveros said, yes, that that can establish fugitive status.
It can establish.
It can. I think in applying an equitable doctrine, the court would have to look at the sum of the facts, and the court would have to determine by the sum of their conduct, were they evading?
So the government would decide who to go after as a fugitive versus the people who just don't show up.
Well, in the typical case, you would have a probation officer who was aware that they weren't reporting. We have an anomaly here where the state didn't alert the federal system that he had been released from custody. So typically, your probation officer would report that in a petition to the court and say he failed to report, or he's not filing regular monthly reports, or he didn't tell me that he moved, and the defendant would be called into court to answer for that. Here, we have an outlier. We have a case where the federal system wasn't aware. The federal term was served concurrently with three or four different state sentences, so it wasn't even clear when he would be released. And
correct me if I'm wrong. Somebody fails to report, probation office, you know, notifies them. Somebody rules them back into court before the judge. Judge looks over and say, did not tell you to report. Yes, you did. All right, I'm going to put you back in jail if you don't show up. You know, that kind of drill, you know, scares the person or whatever. But I'm just clueless that the judge is thinking about, okay, you're now a fugitive. You just disobeyed the rules. You didn't show up when you should. You think I wasn't serious when I said, if you don't report, I'm going to put you in jail. So just this notion of being a fugitive, as counsel is arguing, it's, you know, a little nebulous. I'll just put it that way. I'm not saying you win. I'm just trying to understand the import of the argument.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
And I think it's important to talk about how a fugitive in the supervised release context is different than a fugitive in other contexts like fugitive disentitlement, statute of limitations. You have severe sanctions in those contexts, and so courts applying those doctrines have imposed this requirement that you flee or that you hide. But as the court in Muguiar-Oliveros explained, that's not required in fugitive tolling, because here the consequence is merely requiring you to serve the sentence you were supposed to serve in the first place. And so what's required to establish fugitive status is your intentional evasion of that sentence. And that's what we have here. Judge O'Connor made the factual determination at the revocation hearing that Mr. Swick became a fugitive when he failed to report. He based that on two facts. He said, I told you at your sentencing that you had to report, and the written judgment told you that within 72 hours you had to report. The inference I draw from that is that you knew you had to report and you intentionally failed to. That inference was supported both by his criminal history leading up to that conviction, his repeated violations of parole and probation, and his conduct after he absconded from supervision. He continued unabated violating the law. When Mr. Swick claimed at the revocation hearing it was an accident, the court said, do you have any evidence of that? And he said, no. So at best he offered a competing inference, which is what he does today. But offering a competing inference, even a compelling one, even if this court might have come to a different conclusion, doesn't establish clear error. You have
also, you're talking about the evidence right now, which is where you were directed. Let me ask you about, make sure I'm understanding, though you addressed it to some extent. This is an unusual situation where after he's sentenced with this obligation to report, he then served a fairly lengthy state sentence of 5 years or so. And this period of an obligation to report started when he's released from state prison. Are you saying that the reasonable possibility that after 5 years he's not retained the required memory that he's supposed to have been within 72 hours after finally getting out of state prison, report to federal probation, if he can convince the court of some sort of goodwill here, is that a reason that he's not a fugitive, or is it just, as you said earlier, comes down to equitable factors?
I think if he had produced evidence, a girlfriend, a friend who had said he thought he was done, he told me I'm done with my federal sentence, I've just got this state parole piece, some sort of evidence to indicate that it was an accident or a mistake, that would weigh against...
Was any evidence of probation or the state prison upon his release? Federal probation somehow notified him, by the way, don't forget us, it's been a long time, but we're here, and we want you.
Right.
There's no evidence of that, is there?
We don't have evidence of that. We have evidence that he sustained federal...
What does he have to show? What would he have had to show, and didn't, in your mind, that this is somehow a good faith reason? Of course, there's not a lot of good faith in the story here. I'm not trying to overstate it, but this fellow's done some bad acts. But we're going to make some law here, potentially, and we need to get it right. So what would have excused him? You talk about some friend excuse would have. It seems to me a guy who's been in state prison doing thinking of a lot of other things other than reporting this federal probation officer would easily just not recall that he was supposed to be doing this.
Sure.
That's not good enough?
And like I said, that's a fair inference. It's a competing inference. But Judge O'Connor reached a different conclusion based on his criminal history.
But you're saying that would be sufficient so long as Reed O'Connor accepted it.
I think on the sum total of the record, it's Judge O'Connor's role to look at that defendant and say, you did this on purpose, or you've provided me with evidence that you didn't. And I do think...
So intent does matter.
It does. It has to be conduct, that wrongful conduct that is... you know, action or inaction, right? I don't think fugitive tolling would apply if there was evidence that it was an accident, but here we have an explicit finding at the revocation hearing that it wasn't, that he intentionally failed to report to evade that component of his sentence. That inference was supported not only by his history, but by his conduct after he absconded. He didn't comply with any of the provisions of supervision that would have applied to him. He possessed controlled substances, possessed a firearm, didn't report, didn't engage in counseling. I don't want to interrupt you, Judge Southwick. You look like you have a question.
You never know about what I'm doing over here. No, I didn't have a question.
Okay. Committed other
crimes. I'm waiting.
Okay. So there were a list of conditions, not only beyond failure to report, that he didn't comply with, right? We're not just talking about a failure to report. We're talking about his continued violations that precluded the court from exercising supervision over him, which meant he didn't serve a single day of this key component of his federal sentence. If there's a textbook example of somebody that needs supervision, it's Mr. Swick. He's an established gang member. His first conviction was for crossing into Oklahoma, stealing guns, and bringing them back in to give to other gang members. That sentence was served concurrent with a state sentence for engaging over 100 burglaries in the span of a month. He needed close federal supervision when he got out. He knew that. Federal supervision is not state parole. State parole is, we're going to let you out, and within 3 to 6 months, as long as you don't break the law again, you're going to be discharged from parole. Federal supervision is a list of stringent conditions, close supervision, and severe consequences if you don't comply. Mr. Swick knew that. He wanted nothing to do with that, so he walked away.
Counsel, I think there's a legal issue in this case, too. You want to move to that?
I do, and I want to start by talking about your question of the evidence from sort of this amorphous time period in the 80s and the 90s. I've done a fair amount of research myself. It's clear as mud, but I wanted to give you at least
that
a couple...
clear? I think you're exaggerating.
I wanted to give you a couple of cases that might help elucidate the issue. United States versus Crane, which is 979 F. 2nd 687. That's Ninth Circuit out of 1992. Sort of the quintessential case cited by the Ninth Circuit line of cases dealing with fugitive tolling. The court in Crane said, look, we don't rely on 4210. We don't rely on these parole statutes to find that the passage of time is not service of sentence. We rely on the common law doctrine of fugitive tolling. So it looked at that parole statutory framework and said, we don't need any of that because we have this centuries-old doctrine.
Well, the centuries-old doctrine seems primarily to deal with incarceration, that it's tolled while the person is incarcerated on some other offense, and also tolled if somebody leaves prison for a while, not probation, but has the sentence to serve is told while the person disappears and comes back. There seems to be very little law on tolling something that looks like supervision or parole or probation in a circumstance like this. I didn't put a question mark on that, but that was meant to be a question. Is that a fair assessment of the law?
I think it's been applied in both contexts. The cases that I
certainly recently since Reform Act, but I'm talking about if we're looking at what the law was, the common law that Cartagena Lopez panel wanted to deal with, I tried to find it. And maybe it is set out in this Ninth Circuit opinion, you say, but I'm asking you, is it some real history of something like this being told?
So Anderson versus Coral was in the parole context, not the escape from custody context. You have Fisher, where you're talking about tolling it in the probation context, which, of course, probation is imposed in lieu of imprisonment. I would say that the vast majority of recent case law does deal with more of the absconding from supervision because it was a new scheme enacted by Congress, you know, by virtue of the Sentencing Reform Act. So the body of common law being relied on by the Cartagena opinion is certainly more premised on, like you said, serving the concurrent sentences or escaping from custody. But the court found that the logic and the reasoning behind that doctrine applied with equal force to this context, because supervised release is a crucial component of the sentence. The defendant is obligated to serve that component of his sentence. And Mr. Swick here, in effect, served half his sentence. He did the custodial time, but he never did the supervised release term. He served not one day on supervised release.
So why is this tolling? You were listening to my comments to your opposing counsel. It seems to me tolling means that you're extending the time period in which something is to be accomplished and what other words might go. That's not what's going on here. This is the original time period for Swick during which he was supposed to be supervised, but he wasn't being supervised. So it's not really being told. I'm not sure that it ought to be a difference, but nonetheless, factually, it doesn't look like tolling to me. It looks like you're trying to put in place something that wasn't in place.
Right. And so the tolling comes in because of the date of revocation, not because of the date of his violations. So when he got out in September of 2017, the original expiration date would have been September of 2019. We have to add 34 days onto the end of that because of a carceral term in state prison. So that would have bumped you 34 days into 2019. Well, then, of course, he gets picked up and serves a 3-year sentence for evading arrest in a motor vehicle. So that kicks the can down the road by my count, 970 total days. Okay? So you add 970 days to the 2-year term of supervised release, and that would get you to June 29th, 2022. That would mean the court would have had to exercise its power to revoke unless a warrant had been issued before that date. Because the court didn't know that he had been released and because he never reported for supervision, that didn't happen. But a warrant is not required for the court to exercise authority under the fugitive tolling doctrine. So the tolling comes in because Mr. Swick didn't come to the attention of the authorities until a couple months later in September 2022 when he was picked up for the new federal offense. I think
tolling the application of the conditions of supervised release, you're tolling the need to revoke.
Yes. And I want to highlight the fact that a lot of hay has been made over his repeated arrests and he was hiding in plain sight and it's been, you know, 1,000 days since he started serving. This was not a case where he was revoked 10 years down the road because probation realized he never reported. Okay? The date that he could have been revoked, roughly June 29th, 2022, he's picked up again September 15th, 2022. That tolls the term of supervision again because he's been in continuous custody since September 15th, 2022. I confirmed with BOP that term of state imprisonment was credited as time served towards this new federal sentence. So none of that counts towards his term of supervised release. At most, 73 days passed from the time that jurisdiction would have restarted until when they picked him up again in September of 2022.
Well, counsel, doesn't this argument about tolling run up against some inconsistency, at least with 3483I, which says when the revocation can occur after the period of supervision, so long as a warrant was issued before, which means there's a gap towards the end of revocation where those are just can't be dealt with, so long as he went into supervision and where else. And you have reversed that, or right. eliminated, not reversed it, you have eliminated that when the person never reports to supervision at all. So if we're trying to read the statute and how it applies in different scenarios, it seems to me it's inconsistent with what 3483I is doing.
So I think it's completely consistent.
Well, of course.
Uh-huh. It's an equitable carve-out for when the defendant's wrongful action or inaction precludes the court from issuing that warrant. We have intentional conduct here in intentionally evading service of his sentence, which then directly led to the fact that the court wasn't aware that he was in violation and never issued the warrant. And that's why in Mont versus United States, the Supreme Court explained that preserving jurisdiction under 3583I is not a prerequisite to a court maintaining authority under 3624E, nor does it impact the tolling calculation under 3624E. So we know from the Supreme Court that 3583I is not a jurisdictional prerequisite to exercising tolling authority under 3624. Which is why we have an equitable remedy. If you have a defendant whose wrongful action or inaction caused a warrant not to be issued, the courts have filled the gap with an equitable doctrine that says passage of time is not service of sentence. And we're going to step in to make sure that this defendant does not get a windfall from his own wrongful conduct in failing to report. We're not going to treat it as though he served his sentence. He's going to be held accountable for that. And he will be required to serve that term, which is exactly what happened in this case. I want to briefly address in the time that I have left the argument that the parole statutes were not carried over and that that's somehow evidence that fugitive tolling should not be applied. The case cited by the appellant, Barrier versus Beaver, does not treat 4210 as a fugitive tolling provision. It treats the sum total of provisions under 4210 much like the delayed revocation provision of 3583I. Barrier versus Beaver involved the government asking the court to toll the term from the time that he failed to report. And the court declined and said, we're going to toll the period from issuance of warrant to execution of warrant. And it treated the sum total of those parts much like a delayed revocation provision where the court's jurisdiction was extended. So this is not a case of prior statute had A and B and the court carried A over. In fact, 3624E is not a direct carryover from the prior parole regime, which is another reason that you can't apply the negative implication doctrine. 3624E removes the prior parole scheme, gave the parole commission the discretion to decide if it would run new sentences concurrent or consecutive, and it did not include the 30-day temporal limitation. Congress looked at that and said, we're going to remove that discretion, and we're going to say non-custodial sentences run concurrent. Custodial sentences in connection with a conviction longer than 30 days are tolled. They'll be run consecutive. So it changed the scheme under both. You have both provisions incorporated, and the undercurrent through all of this is the steady beating drum of fugitive tolling. When you have a defendant whose wrongful conduct removed them from the court's supervision in contravention of the very purpose of the supervised release statute, they're not going to be rewarded for that conduct, and they're going to be held to the terms of their sentence.
Let me ask you. Counsel opposite mentioned the First and the 11th Circuit's rulings here. So don't we have a circuit split? I mean, our case in Cardena was withdrawn because the issue was moot, so we don't really have a case there. So my question to you, there's a split in the circuits, the First and 11th, I forget the other circuits, 3rd, 5th, or whatever. At any event, what's your response in terms of the split and, you know, where this panel should be in the split? So some have rejected the argument that you're making, right?
Right.
The First and 11th, so just succinctly, we'd have a circuit split, right?
That is correct. We believe Cartagena-Lopez was properly decided. Cartagena-Lopez looked at the reasoning of the First, and it said that's not persuasive. We don't think Expressio Unius should apply. Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. If it wanted to get rid of this centuries-old doctrine, it would, and it didn't. And we have to go through this convoluted 20-minute argument about this statute moving over and that statute moving over. If it meant to get rid of this well-established doctrine, it would have. That logic is sound. Its statutory interpretation is sound.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. If Congress wanted to get rid of this well-established doctrine, it would have. How would it have done that? There would have been a footnote in the statute saying it's gone?
Well, you could have communicated exclusivity by saying a defendant's term is only told during a later custodial sentence. You could have said, you know, when a defendant absconds, the period is not told. There are a number of ways they could have been explicit about removing that doctrine from application, but they didn't do that. And so we believe the logic of Cartagena-Lopez is sound, that we should fall on the side of the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 9th circuits in applying the fugitive tolling doctrine, and that the 1st and the 11th circuits were erroneously decided.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Brown, you have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points on the law before a quick conclusion on the facts. So I'll begin with Cartagena-Lopez. I think the panel in Cartagena-Lopez did the best it could with what it had. If you go look at the briefing in that case, the defendant had not raised the tolling issue before the district court, and they did not raise the tolling issue in the initial brief. So there's no development of the statutory or common law history, and there's no request for this court to apply negative implication. Now, moving on to the broader circuit split, if you go look at what the 9th, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th circuits have done, they aren't really applying negative implication either. They're just importing this common law rule originally applicable to parolees and escaped convicts into a new context. But I don't think the common law has any role to play in this new context because supervised release is something completely new. For the first time ever, someone would serve a term of supervision not in lieu of an undischarged term of imprisonment, but as an in-between stage between imprisonment on the one hand and complete freedom on the other. So I don't think there's any room for the common law to apply, but even if it does, 3624E affects a change to the common law with clarity for all the reasons that we discussed earlier, and with regard to 3583I, which supports the negative implication by rendering a fugitive tolling doctrine unnecessary. So long as probation is doing their job, there's no need for fugitive tolling because a warrant will issue as soon as someone becomes a fugitive, and that will preserve the district court's authority to revoke.
Let me ask you this. You may have already covered it, but why should we depart from Cartagena-Lopez?
I think the best reason to depart from Cartagena-Lopez is the issue of the arguments that are presented in that case. The defendant simply did not present negative implication. Negative implication requires 20-minute arguments because it depends on context, which includes the statutory scheme in its entirety. And so those arguments weren't very well presented. Given the party presentation principle, we don't necessarily expect that panel to go beyond the arguments that were presented. So the panel primarily relied on the competing arguments then existing in the circuit split. Since then, the 11th Circuit has come in, and I think the 11th Circuit has done the best job of situating 3624E in both statutory and common law history. And the 11th Circuit also has done something, Judge Southwick, in response to a few of the issues you've raised, which is recognize that we're not really talking about fugitive tolling when we're talking about fugitives in supervised release, because the clock doesn't stop when they become a fugitive and then pick back up, because those conditions apply throughout the entire term and into perpetuity, is what we have here. We're not saying that the sentence tolled, the conditions didn't go away after he didn't appear for his initial meeting. They remained in place. We're just talking about the district court's authority to revoke, but 3583I already answers that question for us. With the last 2 minutes, I want to turn to the facts in hopes of illustrating the error with a few examples. If a client misses a meeting, I don't immediately assume that the client is a fugitive. And I could not infer from that missed meeting that they were a fugitive. I would need more information. I would need to conduct more investigation, which is what we'd expect probation to do if they had not dropped the ball in this case, but they did. And in the same way that you couldn't infer from a single missed drug test the defendant's refusal to comply with a condition requiring drug testing, the district court overlooked an evidentiary gap in this case and reached a conclusion that is not reasonably supported by the facts before it. Last, Your Honors, I just note that the government has made quite a bit about Mr. Swick's criminal record, but that is not a factual basis the district court relied upon below to find that he was a fugitive. The district court's ruling on that point was very clear and consistent. You'll see it between pages 79 and 85, which is the revocation transcript, but it's most clear at 84 and 85. The district court explains, I'm finding that you were a fugitive because I'm finding that you knowingly failed to attend that first meeting. So, Judge Southwick, you had some good questions about whether or not that's a fair inference.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. But you know, whether or not that's a fair inference is, I think, an interesting question. I'm taking that inference on its own terms. I'm just saying that even if that's true, even if we can infer that he knowingly failed to attend that initial meeting, that makes him a violator, not a fugitive. And there's a massive chasm between a discrete single sin of omission on the one hand and the types of acts or intent on the other that we would need to find fugitive status. If there are no further questions, I'll see you.
There is a question that probably was more for your able opponent. But let me ask you, I was struck by how probation and coming up with what these eight or nine different offenses were, Cho ended, didn't choose any outside of the time frame of the original supervised release. Though there were other offenses, I think, that it committed after the end of that period, which is almost, I want to say, an indication it's whatever decision was made. It's an avoidance of going beyond the initial period of tolling, the initial period of supervised release, and say any of those would be relevant to revoking the probation, the supervised release that he had, which is sort of counter to the argument being made here. Do you have any understanding, I don't know what your role was in district court, as to why those eight or nine offenses and not any that occurred in later in 19 or 20 were used?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I guess my best guess would be this. That initial petition actually recommended just discharging Mr. Swick entirely. It said, look, we dropped the ball. We neglected to capture his release from TDCJ, and we were not able to follow up on that initial failure to report. So just cut him loose, and we can deal with him on this new 922G count. The district court rejects that recommendation, orders probation to issue a petition, and perhaps the issue that you've identified was probation's way of addressing their initial concerns while nevertheless staying true to 3624E. It's not really clear from the record. I don't know. But what is clear is that ultimately probation dropped the ball here. They're the party that we would expect to do the investigation necessary to establish whether or not Mr. Swick was a fugitive, and here they did nothing. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Counsel, both sides, the case is well briefed and argued. We appreciate the enlightenment. The case will be submitted.